If you're in a position of leadership, whether in the home or on the job, you've endured seasons of conflict when the pressures feel overwhelming. At those moments of crisis, you have a choice to make. You can either step up and resolve them, or you can acquiesce and see if the problems will solve themselves. Today on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll points to Nehemiah as an outstanding model of successful leadership. We're in Nehemiah 13. It's here we're reminded that when troubles flare up, the most effective leaders take problems by the throat.
If you will turn with me to the 13th chapter, you will come across four great problems that Nehemiah took by the throat. He was determined not to let them conquer him or the people that he ruled over. And when he came back to the city after being gone for some time, he discovered four great areas of wrong. The first problem is revealed in verses 4 through 9, and it is the problem I would like to call the problem of a compromising companionship. To appreciate it, you've got to understand the main characters of the problem. Verse 4 introduces them to us. Prior to this, Eliashib, the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of God, being related to Tobiah, had prepared a large room for him. Tobiah, historically, through the book, has been the enemy of God. Nehemiah has faced him time and again as Tobiah tried to stop the building of the wall, as he criticized and attacked and assaulted Nehemiah personally. But all the way through, Nehemiah made sure that he never got inside the walls. Tobiah is the classic example of the rebellious unbeliever who tries every way in the world to thwart the work of God. But while Nehemiah was gone, Eliashib had said, "Let's prepare a room for Tobiah." And then Nehemiah says, "I was gone," verse 6. And then he says in verse 7, "I came to Jerusalem and I learned about the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah." What did Nehemiah do about it? Verse 8 says, "I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room." Why, having Tobiah in the house of God is like having a possum in the chicken coop. You don't prepare a room for a possum in the chicken coop. You keep him out. It would be like putting a rattlesnake in your sleeping bag and telling him to stay in his place and you'll stay in yours and leave you alone. I think it'd be perhaps like putting a bust of Luther in the Vatican. Sort of the same type of thing. Tobiah had no reason to be in the house of God, but he was there. Sure enough, Nehemiah found him and began to throw the stuff out. I love verse 9 because it's just so earthy. "I gave an order and they cleansed the rooms. They fumigated that place." He didn't want even the smell of Tobiah to hang around the place of God. He didn't want anything that smelled or spoke of Tobiah to hang around any longer. And so he carried out his plan. Isn't it interesting? We don't know how to get mad about the right thing. We get mad about the wrong thing. Now, you cannot convince me in 1,000 years that Nehemiah folded his hands and said, "My, that is a shame." Now, we must pray about what we should do with Tobiah's belongings. You know. He looked at that. He got that door open and he said, "Haul that stuff out." Been to carry it out, all of his stuff, his, you know, socks, underwear, all that stuff that the guy's got in there, his furniture, got it all out, hosed it down, cleaned it all up. Now it's ready. "Bring in the grain." Can you imagine Tobiah coming home that night? Room full of grain, you know? Why? Why did he do that? Because he was determined he would not live with wrong in a place that was built for right. But some of us have not become convinced of that. Your companionships will determine your character. Those that you run with will be like those that you become. And frankly, I think it is time to exhort every one of us in the realm of our companionships, not just the school group, but all of us. Who do you spend your time with? Do you have any idea of the effect that that is having on your life personally? I could not number the parents who have said to me, you know, it all started with the wrong friendship. And then the sordid history began to be laid out. Or how many men have shared with me, you know, it all started when I allowed this individual to really have an impact on my life. And it tore me down. Nehemiah took this problem by the throat. He reminds me of Daniel. You remember Daniel? The king said, bow down and worship the image, or you'll be killed, thrown in with the lions. Daniel didn't bow down and worship the image. He went back to his room and prayed. Ooh, they hated him for that. So they turned him in, trumped up charge, and put him in the lion's den. You know why the lions didn't eat Daniel? He was 3/4 gristle, 1/4 backbone. That's why. He was a man of conviction. You can't swallow gristle and backbone. You can't even bite into it. Nehemiah said, I don't care if it means losing votes. I'm not interested in being governor again. I'm not interested in a popularity contest. I'm interested in cleansing the evil that's in the temple of God. But we are not in that camp. Are we? An unholy alliance has marked many a life and taken a terrible toll on it. We'll be back to it in just a moment. Look at the next problem. The next problem is what I would call a financial fiasco. Verses 9 through, let's say 15. 9 through 14. I also discovered, verse 10 begins, and by the way, that means he was looking. A leader keeps his eyes open. The theme of Nehemiah is leadership. A leader does not walk around in a blind state. He listens. He looks. Every parent worth his Christian salt is looking and listening to what his kids are doing. He's listening carefully to the music that comes into his ears. He knows what's going on behind the door that stays closed. I appreciate so much the article that came out recently in a Christian publication that talks about the dangers of isolation and solitude. In some rooms today, we cannot get along as a family, so what do? We disintegrate, and we give even phones and the televisions and the music and the locks on the door so each person can have his own isolated chamber. To develop what? To develop what? His own lifestyle. Broken with the family, now alone. No wonder our world is an independent, lonely place to live. No wonder the Christian has to turn a flip when he comes on Sunday and is asked to touch someone else, to greet him with a word of love. We're not built that way. Nehemiah discovered something that was wrong, and he had looked carefully toward it. What did he find? Well, he found that the portions of the Levites had not been given to the Levites, so that the Levites and the singers who performed the service had gone away, each to his own field. What does that mean? Well, in those days, under the Jewish economy, there was a plan whereby the people who lived and served in the temple would draw their living from the temple. People who sang were supported by people who attended. People who ministered as the tribe of the Levites would derive from the paying of the tithe their income. Many people today, and I am one of them, prefers to continue a method of tithing in their own giving. But I do not see it as a requirement in our day. I see it as a choice, and it seems as though if it was a good plan then, it would work today, and indeed it does. But in those days, as I might add today, there was selfishness in the realm of money. Nehemiah came and he found, you know, the singers and the Levites were living out in the suburbs. They belonged in the temple, deriving their income from the temple, but there was no income. That is what is implied here. And so what does he do? Does he say, let's pray about it? My, this is something that we ought to have a committee meeting about. Verse 11 doesn't suggest that. Verse 11 says, I reprimanded the officials. Well, he's losing more votes the longer we go through this passage, isn't he? Nehemiah was a man like that. He said, this is wrong. God requires in the law a paying of the tithe, and you're not doing it. And so he pulled together men who were the officials, and he said, why is the house of God forsaken? I gathered them together and restored them to their post. After this rebuke, this reprimand, and by the way, the word means to strive with someone. It means to make a loud noise. I suggest he raised his voice. He rebuked them verbally. He said, in effect, this has no place in the life of God's people. And then he suggested a plan of change. And he put it into operation. And then it says in verse 14 that he prayed, oh my God, remember me. Do not blot out my loyal deeds which I have performed for the house of my God and its services. Before I go another step, I want to say that I do believe there is a great place for prayer. I believe there are certain problems in one's life that only prayer will provide the answer. Nothing can be done. So please do not misunderstand. I am not saying that when one prays about a problem that is a mistake or that he is doing less than he should. There are some problems that require only prayer. But when there are areas that are directly disobedient to what God has said, the answer is not to pray about it. Prayer becomes, in that case, a spiritual cop-out. It becomes a nice, neat guilt remover. Prayer isn't needed. Obedience is needed. Some of you need to take a long look at the disciplines of giving. You need to take a long evaluation, especially in our day of tight money. Need to take a long look at what part does God have in my plans for giving. If you were, without this exhortation, to have made a list of the things that are part of your expenditures, where would the Lord's part find its place on the list? Last? Toward the end? Why not first? All that we are and all that we have and all that we hope to be come down from his gracious hands, with whom there is no variation, neither shadow caused by our turning. The financial fiasco is not limited to Nehemiah's day. It fits some lives today. Along with this matter of a compromising companionship. But there is a third problem. It begins in verse 15 and goes down through verse 22. It is a problem that I would like to call the secularized Sabbath. The secularized Sabbath. In those days, now Nehemiah here again is doing some investigating. He says, in those days I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath. and bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys as well as wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads. And they brought them into Jerusalem, he repeats, on the Sabbath day. Now let's understand, the Sabbath day has never been and never will be Sunday. Under the Jewish economy, the Sabbath was Saturday, the day of rest. It was in observance of that day that our wonderful Creator God set aside the work in his creative week and rested, not because he was tired. Omniscience and omnipotence never gets tired. But God set aside rest in observance, or to begin the observance of that particular day. And so it was. The Jews put it together in their law, and they began to carry it out as a regular habit of life. At least, they said they would, according to chapter 10 and verse 31 of this book. It's worth a look. Look at 10:31. The people themselves signed this covenant. Some of you will remember that message. The people of the land who bring wares or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or a holy day. We will forego the crops the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. In other words, we will observe to the letter a spiritual day of rest. Well, Nehemiah, back in chapter 13, was walking through the city and began to observe the merchants were still at it. Why, grain was still being sold, loads were brought in through the gates, taken back out, profit sharing, profit making, expenditures of monies, and receiving of goods. Nehemiah must have shaken his head. The promise was still fresh in his memory. It says in verse 15, the last sentence, I admonished them on the day they sold food. Why, men of Tyre who were living there imported fish, all kinds of merchandise, and sold them to the sons of Judah, he repeats, on the Sabbath. Nothing wrong with making a profit, nothing wrong with having a good business. Even if it's a fish business, that's great. Just don't do it on the Sabbath. And so what does he do about it? Does he simply pray? Does he passively say, my, we really need to do something about this, man? Well, look at what he does. He takes it by the throat. Verse 17, I reprimanded the nobles. Same word. It means to shout, to be agitated in the mind. And I said to them, what is the evil thing you are doing by profaning the Sabbath day? Verse 19. It came about that just as it grew dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath. By the way, let me help you orient. That would be Friday evening at sundown. The day in those days began at 6 o'clock in the evening and ran, of course, its 24 hours to the next 6 o'clock in the evening. The next increment of time in that period would be the beginning of the next day. So the Sabbath was from our time, 6 o'clock Friday, to 6 o'clock Saturday. So as the sun began to go down, Nehemiah said, shut the gates. The Sabbath is coming. I commanded the doors to be shut, and they should not open them until after the Sabbath. Did he leave it at that? Oh, no. Merchants have a way of picking locks. They can get right in those gates. You've got to watch those guys. Not all of them, some of them. And it says, I stationed some of my servants at the gates that no load should enter on the Sabbath day. Now, I love the next two verses. Once or twice, the traders and merchants of every kind of merchandise spent the night outside the gate, outside Jerusalem. Now, do you think Nehemiah won many friends among those guys that had fish outside the gate in Jerusalem 24 hours? You think that bothered him? I warned them. I said to them, look at this 21st verse. Why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do so again, I will use force against you. You know, kind of the biblical way of saying, I'll punch you in the mouth. That's what he's saying. If you do that again, I'll take you on. You say, man, that wouldn't drive him away. Force doesn't do it. Oh, really? Look at verse 22. Verse 21 says, from that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. Remarkable. He knew what to get mad about. We don't. We know what to be impatient about. We get mad at the other guy. We don't get mad at ourselves. We get angry at irritating things where we don't get our rights. God says, wait a minute. Take that up with me. Let's look at this thing from my viewpoint. You know, you say back to God, but under these circumstances, God says, what are you doing under there? But you don't understand. I understand perfectly. I realize that. Absolutely. You see, we have developed a fantastic system of rationalization where we always come out on top. Nehemiah said, don't come back on the Sabbath. Come back on Sunday. Saturday's the day we honor our God. My Christian friend, today there may be convictions God has given you. I'm not prepared to structure it for you. But if God has given you conviction in certain areas, you had best carry it out. You had best have the gristle that's necessary to say, no, I will not, or yes, I will continue. Because there will always be individuals who will want to change your standard to fit theirs. I'm saying to you, the answer is to take the problem by the throat.
Well, some great counsel coming from our Bible teacher, Chuck Swindoll. He titled today's message, Taking Problems by the Throat. And there's a lot more application coming ahead. Plus, Chuck has come by the Insight for Living studio to share a personal comment with our listening family. So stand by for that. But first, if you'd like to learn more about this ministry, visit us online at insightworld.org. And then I want to let you know that your notes to Insight for Living are such an encouragement to us. And if you're among those who financially support this ministry, you should be encouraged by the comments we receive. Each one is a testimony to the value of your gift. I want you to hear this moving testimony from one of your fellow listeners. Recently, a pastor's son left a heart-rending comment on our website. He described the years he spent chasing personal satisfaction. Though happily married and the father to several healthy children, his private life was a mess. Secretly, he started dabbling in a double life. After years of inner turmoil, God brought him to his knees. This man finally submitted himself to God and gave his life to Christ. And then, while scrolling through radio stations in his car, he found a familiar voice. His closing paragraph said this, God worked through Insight for Living in those first days of my new life with him. God has blessed me in so many ways, and it's an honor and a blessing for me to be able to give back to the ministry that helped me get my spiritual footing. And then he added, to God be all the glory. Here's Chuck.
Aren't you glad that God didn't put conditions on our relationship with him? I certainly am. Like, he didn't say, hey, Chuck, once you clean up your act, then come see me. Nor did he say, my grace is sufficient for you, as long as you don't mess up. No, that's all silliness. Jesus said, my grace is all you need. And he meant it. On another occasion, he declared his mission. God sent me to heal the brokenhearted. Yes, that's the God I know. He's the author of grace. He's the one who meets us at our deepest point of pain, heartache, and brokenness, and he wipes a tear that's rolling down our cheek. He's the one who pursues us time after time, even when we've made a mess of things. From our first broadcast back in 1979 until now, Insight for Living has been a safe harbor for imperfect people. We invite the sinful to listen. You see, every one of us, including me, has reason to feel guilty and ashamed. And yet, our faithful God, who is rich in mercy, grants us grace. Grace for the moment. My friend, we're moving to the close of yet another year. If God has ever prompted your spirit about coming alongside Insight for Living with a generous gift, now's the time to respond to His call. Your gift, no matter the size, will be channeled directly into beaming this message of grace far and wide. By giving a special year-end gift to Insight for Living, someone just like you will come to understand the sweet words of Jesus when He said, "My grace is all you need. My power works best in weakness." So come. Come, you who are weary, and I will give you rest. Thank you for your gift that you're going to send today.
Thanks, Chuck. You can get in touch with Insight for Living right now by calling us. If you're listening in the United States, call 800-772-8888. That number again, 800-772-8888. Or if you prefer to give online, go to insight.org/donate. I'm Bill Meyer. Join us next time when Chuck Swindoll concludes his practical message on taking problems by the throat on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, Taking Problems by the Throat, was copyrighted in 1974, 1983, 1990, 2007, and 2016. And the sound recording was copyrighted in 2016 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.